Welcome to Democratically 2020, the podcast all about the politics, policies, and personalities of the 2020 US election. I'm your host, Karen Robinson. So I want to welcome to the podcast Dr. Mark Pack. Mark is currently the president of the Liberal Democrat Party here in the United Kingdom. Mark is also a writer, a commentator, an activist, a political organizer, a former colleague of mine for many years ago. We worked together for a good long while, and the author of two excellent books, which are highly relevant to this podcast. One called 101 Ways to Win an Election, and the book he's here to talk to us about today, Bad News: What the Headlines Don't Tell Us. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Karen. Lovely to see you again. As you say, see, feels like a long time since we were work colleagues. An awful lot has happened in the world and in politics to make that era feel a long time ago.
For sure, it has been quite a while ago. I think it was the 2010 UK general election was happening around the time we were working together, and then after that,
what counted as a political scandal back then seems quite tame by comparison. I was sort of slightly pinching myself when there was the whole thing with Donald Trump and bleach. Obviously, health announcement: don't drink bleach to be healthier. It won't
to be clear.
But that, I think in 2010, if you or I had been watching some political satire, and whether maybe the thick of it in here in the UK, and that there'd been a joke around that, we would have thought that was so improbable.
Yeah.
And yet now it's not just plausible in satire, it's actual reality.
Yeah, I think the satirists are kind of out of work right now. There's nowhere to go.
Yeah. Where do you go after bleach?
Yeah, I mean, a colleague of mine said to me the other day, Armando Iannucci has taken over the show running for reality. So what a world. What a world. But we're here to talk about Bad News, which is the cracking book that you've written all about the media. And I thought it was really fascinating because a lot of people have criticized the media for specific problems that they've had or specific mistakes that they've made. But the argument of this book is more about almost the business as usual ways that the media operates. What is it that you see our press getting wrong, and why does that happen?
And there are two fundamental problems, one which we can be generous about and one maybe slightly less generous about. The generous one is that the basic structure of the news, so telling you things that have happened differently very recently, is a pretty poor way of understanding the world. That quite often understanding what's going on in the world involves things that are dull or slow moving or very gradual, relentless trends over long periods of time. And all those sorts of things basically don't make the news. The news is all about the exceptional, the unusual. And sometimes that is an accurate representation of the world, but it misses out huge parts of what's going on. The other problem with the news, where one can be a little bit more generous in understanding the underlying flaws, but there is a bit of criticism definitely in this, is that the news is really desperate to grab your attention. Because for most news outlets, even if they're non-commercial, some sense of is their audience up or down is a big driving force in the organisation. So here in the UK, for example, TV news channels that run adverts, trying to get an audience is really important. But even the BBC, which is not advertising funded, has a big concern about what its audience levels are. And so that desire to attract an audience results in headlines in particular, but not just headlines, often looking to lure you in a way that the truth doesn't really justify. So to give an example that I talk about in the book, there was this controversy in West London fairly recently around residents wanting a local youth club to be closed and replaced with something else. And I don't know the details of the case. I have no idea of the rights or wrongs of whether the youth club is a lovely local service that NIMBY residents are wrong to be opposed to, or maybe the youth club is actually genuinely inappropriate for the venue that it's in. The fascinating thing, though, from the point of view of understanding the news, is the Guardian newspaper ran a story about this, and they talked about what residents wanted to be done with the site instead of a youth club. And two of the options the story talks about are, one is to replace it with a private library. The other is to replace it with a coffee shop. The headline was all about residents want to replace youth club with coffee shop. Now that sounds really, I should be outraged by what, you know, how on earth can these selfish residents be thinking that? Of course, if the headline had been residents want to replace youth club with library, that would have been, oh, that's a bit weird, but they're both good virtuous things that are, you know, communities should have probably. It would have set the whole tone of the story and people's emotional reactions off completely differently. Why did The Guardian choose one headline than the other? Well, of course, the one that sounds outrageous is the one that grabs our attention, that makes us click through, that makes us read down the story, even though the truth would have been just as well, if not maybe better served by the alternative headline.
Yeah. And I think one of the lessons from that, from election campaigning, is that politicians, and in particular I'm thinking the current president of the United States, become quite media savvy, and they start doing things and saying things specifically to generate that kind of attention. And Donald Trump is particularly good at saying anything he thinks will get attention, whether he thinks it's positive or negative for himself. And in a way, he's kind of hacked the news cycle, because he just dominates coverage all the time. What are the special challenges for a media organization in that kind of environment, when they're basically given constant sugar? Here's more good stuff I can report on.
Well, the thing that Donald Trump is very skillful at is being inaccurate in ways that are not wholly false. Now, that might sound a bit odd, particularly coming from me, in some ways defending what Donald Trump says. But to give an example, when there was a big controversy a little while ago about untrue claims he made about the murder rate in Chicago, you know, those were straightforwardly untrue, inaccurate. However, it is also true that, particularly to say British eyes, the murder rate in Chicago is shockingly high. You know, it is a major problem. And so by exaggerating the scale of the problem so far that he took it into something being completely untrue, that's definitely something we should condemn and something the media should critique and so on. But the risk is, when you're arguing over the accuracy of a number, when there is actually a genuine problem there, is it sounds a lot like being pedantic nitpicking. Yeah. And, you know, oh, look, does it really matter if the deaths are, you know, 50 or 100 short? You know, arguing over that sounds like you're missing the point that loads of people are dying. And so that's what Donald Trump, I think, is really skillful at doing. It's perhaps also what in the European referendum campaign here a couple of years back, the Leave campaign, were quite skillful at doing as well, is picking controversies where the argument over whether or not something is true slightly misses the point. And just to give you a different example of this, because I think this is a point that people quite often sort of bridle at a bit, you know, surely the truth is all that matters. How can you possibly think that there's more to it than that? Think about what happens when a film or a TV series gets made about somebody's life. A nice example of this is a film I watched, finally got round to watching not that long ago, about the life of Brian Clough, a famous, very successful and very controversial football manager. And the film takes lots of liberties with the exact sequence of events and what different characters exactly did or didn't do. But it does it in a way that makes for a really effective artistic piece of work, but also one that draws out the truth of the character about Brian Clough really effectively. And of course, that's what artists do all the time. They exaggerate and they omit and they rearrange in order to try to bring out some deeper truth. And in that sense, Donald Trump is somewhat of an artist, that he rearranges the truth. He omits key information. He makes up other bits of information, but to paint a picture. And the thing that I think the media often get wrong, and particularly political campaigners often get wrong, is to think that the only thing you need to do is to engage with the accuracy of the picture. What you also need to do is to engage with that broader question. So in the case of, say, the deaths in Chicago, yes, understanding the scale of them is important, and that is part of what's needed to tackling an issue, but that's not the only thing you need to do.
Yeah. And that's how Trump winds up making himself look like he's some sort of bigger truth teller, as opposed to, you know, the nation's most prominent lawyer, because he comes across as the one who's ignoring all these piddly little, you know, nitpicky arguments and saying, here is a big truth no one else wants to say. It kind of blends conspiracy theory and narrative storytelling and using some of the media's worst instincts against itself.
And it can also work on a much more benign scale. So to take an example of a political podcast I really like listening to, Not Enough Champagne, Corey and Steve, who are the two presenters, will probably be a bit baffled if I tell them that I compared them to Donald Trump in an interview. But the thing that I really like about them is they're both Labour Party supporters, so a different party from mine. And I like listening to them, A, because they do a really good podcast, but B, because their take on the world is different from mine, it helps me remember how other people see things.
Mm-hmm.
But the relevance in this context is that Corey and Steve, when they're talking about the Liberal Democrats, relatively frequently get a particular detail slightly wrong, just as I would if I was talking about another political party, you know, rather than my own. And the thing that so often reminds me is the fact that they might have got a little detail wrong very rarely undermines their argument. And so it's a reminder that if you just zoom in on the factual details, oh, actually, no, it was Paddy Ashdown who did that rather than Charles Kennedy, you can miss the point that the overall argument might still have some validity. And if you want to persuade people to reject that argument, then you need to engage with that rather than the pedantry over, you know, which Dem leader was it in particular who first adopted a particular policy. So apologies to Corey and Steve if they asked this. I promise that's the only respect in which...
In many other crucial respects, I'm sure they're very unlike Donald Trump.
Yeah.
One of the things that strikes me is, because what you're kind of talking about here is context. It's almost the kind of seeing the story at the right level, you know. Yes, getting the details right, but also understanding the thrust of it.
Exactly.
And one of the things that it strikes me has been a real big change in the media landscape over the past decade and a half or so, has been that people are receiving information in a slightly decontextualized format, because we receive so much of our media via social media. And of course, famously, Donald Trump in his 2016 campaign, and again, he's trying in 2020 to run what is largely a Facebook campaign, and also using partisan news outlets like Fox News. And he's now very fond of this One America News Network, which is basically, as far as I can see, propaganda. But he's using the kind of decontextualized social media conversations to drive a small piece of the story into people's minds. And it's not just Donald Trump. I mean, I think this is kind of how the world works nowadays, and it makes people sort of confused and disoriented. Is there anything that we can do to kind of help or encourage people to start consuming media in ways that might be more conducive to understanding?
Yeah, I guess I'm quite an optimist on this front, or maybe I'm a pessimist about the past. Social media often takes stories out of context. On the other hand, it gives you access to other takes and other perspectives massively more easily than used to be the case. So when I was a child growing up, there were, well, for a good chunk of my childhood, only three TV channels in the UK. And the newspaper purchasing habits would be a household would buy one newspaper Monday to Saturday, maybe buy a different newspaper on the Sunday. So your access to different perspectives on stories was nearly non-existent. This was really brought home to me, actually, recently watching the film Fire in Babylon about the West Indian fast bowlers of the 70s and 80s. And as a child, the only take I had on those controversies was through the Times newspaper, because that was the newspaper my dad read. So those were the sports pages I saw, and BBC's test match special radio coverage. I've obviously have learned since that there are rather more aspects to those controversies, particularly if you have a better understanding of the history of the West Indies. But that film really brought home just how lopsided the version of events at the time that I saw through those outlets, in a way that now, when there's a similar controversy, alternative viewpoints are immediately accessible. And a good example of that in the UK is over stories about gun control in America. Obviously, broadly speaking, people all across the political spectrum in the UK just find it anything from baffling to horrifying, the many attitudes towards gun control in the US. But what you can do, courtesy of the internet, is actually find out more about what those other perspectives are. So when there was a lot of controversy a couple of years back about a proposal to tighten gun control in the US that involved using the FBI's sort of list of suspected terrorists, the way that got reported in the UK was basically, those mad American right-wing gun nuts, how could any of them possibly be so obsessed with opposing gun control? They even want possible terrorists to be able to have access to guns. And I remember thinking at the time, well, I'm pretty sure if I was in the US, I would be very heavily in favour of gun control. But does really every opponent of that proposal, is every opponent of them completely mad? And what I could therefore do online is go to things like the Fox News website and hear the other side. Mm. Now, the other side I didn't find convincing, but the other side actually of the argument did make some quite good points about how unreliable that FBI list is. And therefore, if you're introducing gun control on that basis, you're actually introducing gun control in a much less rigorous way than it might sound if you don't really know much about the topic. Now, for me, that wouldn't persuade me to therefore oppose that measure. But it was a really good example of how, if you want to, and that's a big if, but if you want to, the internet, including social media, makes it much easier to check out the other side of a story.
I think there's truth in that. But I think the crucial point is what you said at the end about the if you want to. And I would also add, if you have the time and ability.
That's important.
One of the things that's kind of dispiriting often about American elections, and I suspect probably elections in lots of places, is that the vast majority of the electorate has already made up their mind long since, which means that the people who are the decision makers, the kind of the swing voters who make the impact, whose late decisions will move the election one way or the other, are often the least informed and the least engaged. So you really basically get one chance to get the attention of this very critical group of voters, who are the least likely group of voters to think, that's interesting, I wonder if there's more to that story, let me find out. Now, in some ways, they're actually quite open-minded because they're not partisan. So in some ways, they can be persuaded at the right points. But I think it's, I guess I just would say I'm skeptical that the existence of accurate information is going to be enough. It feels like we need to do a better job of getting, especially into big mainstream outlets, kind of accurate information in the first place, because that may be the only place that the most relevant voters are ever going to hear this information.
Yeah, and there's a related issue, which actually I don't really touch on in the book, but about this fear about what are often called data voids or Google voids, where if you search for a topic, the truth is very hard to find. And an example of this would be, there is a sort of anti-Semitic myth about the first edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica that came out after the Second World War. And I'd spent a bit of time trying to understand exactly the cause of the myth and so on. And the thing that was really striking is, if you go Googling for it, you only get the anti-Semites. It's really hard to dig in to find the truth. And essentially, the reason I'm sure it's a myth is because of my preconceptions about anti-Semitism and about the Holocaust. And in this case, I'm absolutely happy to stand 100% behind my preconceptions as being the right guide to the truth. But one has to be sensibly wary about realizing if that's what you're relying on, that's not really the best of situations. So quite often the problem is the truth is quite hard to find.
Yeah.
Sometimes because it's slow moving, sometimes because it's dull, sometimes just because it's the angle that really nobody is interested in. The thing though is, and I guess this is a thing that maybe just frustrates me a little bit, or I wish the media were better at, the truth is often much more interesting. The full story about why somebody said something that was untrue, or an untrue idea got wide provenance, is often as interesting or more interesting. And so there's a missed opportunity there. And part of it, I think, in Britain is about what to say the BBC see as its role. How important is today's headlines versus accurate information that helps inform people who are looking about something at a slightly slower moving pace.
I think that's a really interesting point, because one of the really valid points that you make in the book is about the media's proclivity for always covering horse race issues. Horse race as defined, as you correctly say, by kind of the who's ahead, and not just in politics, but in anything. You know, is this movie ahead of that movie, as opposed to the substance of it? What is this movie about? What's interesting about it, etc. And actually, there's some reason to believe that, at least in many circumstances, the average American voter, partisans aside, but the average American voter, the kind of the people in the middle of the partisan context, are much more interested in what is this party's position on healthcare than they are in whose party is slightly ahead in the polls. And yet this policy debate, the kind of substance of it, which you know, it can come across as dull if it's badly covered, but there are very interesting ways that you can cover it, and ways of covering it with lots of human interest. It feels like that gets it gets put to one side because it's not what's as interesting to the media, perhaps because, as you said at the beginning, it's not new.
Yeah, and I think that focus on horse race coverage is probably particularly problematic in the US.
Yeah,
it's a little bit less so in other countries that have a combination of a multi-party system and first past the post. Because in Britain, for example, that horse race coverage does at least help inform tactical voting considerations, where supporters of a third or fourth party might be thinking...
Tactical voting is very important to the Liberal Democrats.
Exactly. And so I think there is a bit of legitimate difference there. Whilst in the US, with such a dominant two-party system and the use of first past the post, although I know that's not the US terminology, but, you know, the use of first past the post essentially very heavily in the US presidential election, that's much more problematic if you're just focusing on who's ahead and who's not. As you rightly touched on, though, Karen, I think one of the reasons you do get that coverage is, A, it's easier, and it's easier to make it sound like a fun story, but also critics of it have often therefore swung to wishing that people were interested in long, dull coverage.
Right.
The challenge is to make the rest of what is happening in an election interesting and lively. And that definitely can be done. The best of coverage does that. But it is a hard challenge. Certainly one should at least be fair to the media in acknowledging it's a tough nut to crack.
Yeah. As usual, it all boils down to just try harder.
Exactly.
One of the other things that you point out in the book, in your chapter on kind of the coverage of elections, which I thought was fascinating, and it comes back to the point you were making at the beginning about the kind of whole structure of news is wrongly set up, is that very often everything that happens in a campaign cycle, the things that are obsessively covered by the media, the thing the media is basically there to do, don't impact anything. And the outcome of the election is often determined by factors outside of the campaign cycle. Things that, you know, things like the economy, the likelihood of the incumbent party to win, etc. And that's never how it's covered, because it doesn't feel like an exciting story. To me, that just feels like an argument, which I think is true, that the media just ignore political science.
Yeah. And a good analogy is, imagine, you know, when eventually we have the next Olympics, who knows quite what year that will be in, but when we have the next Olympics, when you get the medal ceremony, so when the three gold, silver, bronze medalists, they walk up to the podium and they get presented their medal. Imagine if the sports commentator was covering the three of them walking up to the podium as if it was a horse race. And, oh, I wonder, you know, is Smith going to walk up to podium number one, or is Jones going to beat Smith to the gold podium? And you think, this is absurd. We already know who's got the gold, silver and bronze. You know, the speed with which they walk and who's closest to which podium is not in any way relevant to which medal they get. But news coverage of elections is often of that nature, as if it's all about what happens in the few weeks running up to polling day, when in fact the results almost always are predominantly about what has happened well before polling day. So there's definitely, as polling day gets near, a really good reason for the media to cover the election much more. The problem is, what the media does is talk then as if the events happening in the last few days of the election are what determines it, rather than saying, look, now you're interested, here, by the way, are the things that happened 3 years ago that are actually really determining the election. And so the whole nature and pitch of election coverage is talking about elections in the wrong way.
Yeah, Which is a problem. However, it's probably more of a problem in the UK than in the US, because in the US, we are a very closely and narrowly divided country. And in some ways, that makes the responsibility on the media much greater, because it is true often that small things can tip an election one way or the other. To many Americans, especially, I would argue, American Democrats, when we think about media misjudgments, the thing that is burned into our brains is what happened in the 2016 election. A number of things about the coverage of Trump versus Clinton, in particular, the relative handling of Hillary Clinton's email scandal compared to what we would perceive as being a raft of equally, if not more serious, Trump scandals, which collectively got only about as much attention as the email scandals and this weighting of it. Do you agree that the media got that wrong in 2016? And if so, what would you suggest they could learn from that experience?
I mean, I think everyone got it wrong in different ways.
Yeah.
Because the other element that certainly in the coverage that you saw in Britain, where I think the media got it wrong, was there was no real conception of the fact that Hillary Clinton, rightly or wrongly, was a massively unpopular candidate. And I guess you'd probably think wrongly, but, you know, rightly or wrongly, yeah, as it was sort of objective fact that going into that election, Hillary Clinton was an extremely unpopular politician by comparison with previous presidential candidates of either party. And so I think there was,
but not by comparison with Trump himself. I mean, that's
no, indeed.
Thing.
I mean,
they were both quite unpopular.
Absolutely. But the coverage was very much in the tone of Donald Trump is phenomenally unpopular.
Yeah.
And oh, Hillary Clinton might be a bit ahead of him, rather than this is the contest of, I think it's pretty close to being true, you know, literally the two most, probably the most unpopular combo of presidential candidates ever.
Yeah.
You know, even if that's not literally true, certainly it was true for a long period of time running up to 2016. Yeah. And so in that sense, I think there was a blindness to Hillary Clinton's unpopularity on the part of many people and media outlets who, push comes to shove, would have preferred her to win. I think there was also a problem definitely in how the media covered Donald Trump, which partly goes back to what we were talking about earlier around sort of pedantry versus big picture. But most crucially, the incentives that drive journalists very rarely point towards success means you need to have both Democrats and Republicans trust you. Now, if you think about the media as in part a predominantly commercial enterprise, you know, one of the basic rules of success, if you're running a commercial enterprise or thinking about a commercial enterprise, is which is the niche that we're going to go after, which is the bit of the market that we're going to try to sell to. And so you have this problem that media outlets, you know, can be really successful if only Republicans trust them by and large. Mm. And they can be really successful if only Democrats trust them by and large. It's one advantage we have in Britain with the BBC, and other countries have in other ways with the other sort of state broadcasters in particular, is that when it's done well, you have a state broadcaster or a broadcaster regulated in some way by the state that has to try to appeal across political divides. So even in Britain, a TV station like ITV, which is a commercial TV station, because of its regulatory framework, if only conservatives in Britain liked it or only Labour supporters liked it, that would be a problem.
Yeah.
And I think what we see in the US is that there is not that much of a market for media outlets that are trusted across the political divide, and therefore each camp ends up, you know, very much to its own. I'm trying not to fall into that habit that everyone falls into of thinking their country is better than other countries. But I do think that model of having a media structure where you have significant media outlets who have to try to appeal across the political divide is genuinely really beneficial. That's not just an attempt at sort of British exceptionalism.
I think the relationship between the US media, especially television media, and the increasingly negative partisan polarization in American politics, it's a bit hard to unpack, because I think it kind of goes both ways. It's
exactly
both cause and effect.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that famously the Republicans some 30, 40 years ago started explicitly trying to create alternative conservative institutions, including media institutions, because they felt, rightly or wrongly, that what were at that time deemed to be sort of neutral media communications, they felt were actually skewed towards towards liberals. So they started creating things like Fox News and so forth. And now we're in this interesting place of, like, on the one hand, I think that these media outlets are responsive to a market, right? So there is a real marketplace for partisan slanted news, but then they also create their own market because increasingly Fox News defines the reality of the world that of the people who watch it, including the president. So it's, we're in a very partisan split place, and it's really hard to see how we'll ever get back to anything like neutral truth in the way that kind of old-fashioned ideas about journalistic objectivity would suggest is possible.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there is a start of a maybe two possible trends in the US media that are hopeful on that front. One is the rise of things like 538, you know, Nate Silver and colleagues, where there is a much more explicit pitch at trying to be
data-led.
I was about to say impartial, but they actually are quite opinionated very often in their pieces, but it's data-led opinion.
So
there's that trend. The other is, I do wonder, with things like the New York Times and its huge phenomenal success in the last few years and the way it's really found a successful financial model online. Now, it is very much pitching itself at a particular viewpoint of the world. So it's not in that sense directly trying to address the divide. But what that does mean is we've got a different now trend to that rise of what were originally very much actually radio based sort of right wing shock jocks and the like in the US. And then that spreading to other formats of media as well. There is now perhaps overall more of a balance returning with just how popular the New York Times has become. And, you know, looking at the figures for example, how many journalists the New York Times employs compared to all the rest of the newspaper industry in the US put together, it is a, I think for people who have been familiar with the New York Times existing for a long time, it's easy to miss just what a behemoth it is now becoming.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the New York Times is a fantastic publication of which I'm a subscriber. So I'm by no means meaning to malign them in any way, shape or form when I say that it's kind of explainable, though, isn't it, by the same partisan divide that we've been talking about. And in other words, right now, Democrats are highly engaged, highly infuriated, and there's a huge appetite and market for news of outrageous things being done by the Trump administration. It makes sense that, therefore, from a commercial point of view, people would then flood to a publication they trust to provide that information. I would argue much more accurately and, you know, in a much more robust way. But still, it still fits into, in certain cycles, people flood to Fox News to get their to get their anti-Democrat bias, and then Democrats flood to institutions like The Times, MSNBC to get their Trump bashing. You know, it's not as simple as that, but it doesn't feel like we're arriving at a consensus. It feels like we're arriving at continuously split realities.
Yeah, I think part of that reflects underlying divisions in US society. Yeah, there's only so much you can expect the editorial direction of a particular media outlet to do to address that. And actually, that leads on to some really interesting research that I touched on in the book, not my own research, but other people's research, about cause and effect between the political views of media owners and their outlets. So, for example, how influential is the owner of a newspaper in influencing its political direction? And the evidence points much more towards people who decide to buy a newspaper picking a newspaper that fits their political views, rather than they buy a newspaper and then order the staff to change their coverage to match their political views. So that if you are, say, have right-wing political views, you don't go looking for a newspaper that appeals to left-wing readers to buy, because you know that you would then be stuck with something where your views and what your business needs to do would be at odds with each other. So right-wing people end up buying right-wing outlets, left-wing people, left-wing outlets, liberal people buy liberal outlets. And therefore the cause and effect is much more driven by the audience, which therefore determines the editorial direction, which therefore determines which owners they end up with. Now, the optimism in that is it does mean that when the audience's views change, they can be much more influential. We had this in Britain back in, I guess the best example is probably back in the early 1990s, where the newspaper landscape in Britain then, as it is now, was very much dominated by right-wing or centre-right newspapers. The newspapers of the time, though, turned massively against the Conservative government. And one of the driving factors was the extent to which their readers were writing in to tell them how badly affected they were by the recession at the time and how unhappy they were with the government. And so as what was happening was not right-wing newspaper owners determining the political agenda, but the readers saying, we now really are unhappy with the government, and the newspapers having to react to that in order to keep their readers, that's a much healthier situation. And so I think there is an important difference here between talking about how the media cover politicians in power with opposition politicians. And this is maybe where the US presidential elections, where you don't have an incumbent, are a little bit different, because you can have that, what is really happening out there, making the media have to reflect that through audience pressure in a way that can work for coverage of incumbents. Of course, people who aren't in power don't have a track record that could ever generate that safety net of an audience reaction.
Yeah, interesting. So, Mark, if you were in the position of, let's say, I were to hand you the opportunity of being the Biden campaign's chief advisor on managing their press relations, what would you advise the Biden campaign to do in terms of A, generating positive coverage of the campaign, and also avoiding negative coverage, given what you know about the instincts and the biases of the media?
One of Biden's great strengths is his personal empathy. And I saw the clip, in fact, maybe earlier today I was watching, or possibly yesterday, when he was on a TV show with John McCain's daughter.
Meghan McCain.
Yes, that's right. And the way that Biden reacted to Meghan McCain talking about the cancer that her father was suffering then was just, you know, amazing. You know, if I ever want to have some horrible personal news arrive when I'm in the company of of a stranger, yeah, you know, Joe Biden is top of my wish list. You know, he's, and so I think what the Biden campaign should do is to look to to tell the story, for example, of coronavirus through Joe Biden showing that empathy and personal support for people who have been really badly affected by it. And I think that set of personal stories can be much more effective than the standard political rhetoric. And one of the reasons I say that is if you look at how people's views have changed over same-sex marriage, you know, that across multiple countries, there's been a massive shift of people's views on same-sex marriage, even though it's an issue that fundamentally is one about gut feel. You know, that facts play a little bit of a role, but it's really about your gut feel. And so why have people's gut feels moved so much? A lot of that is to do with people knowing people. And so if you know somebody who is in a same-sex relationship, that idea that maybe it should be okay for them to marry, it's very different than if it's, you know, something that you've never encountered and it's an abstract issue or something seen through the prism of very partisan media. So I think with coronavirus, telling the story about Trump's failures through those personal stories and those personal connections, I think will be much more effective than through the traditional forms of political communication.
Yeah, and it sort of points out a weakness, which we sort of touched on earlier, that the Democrats have some of the same weaknesses that the media do, in that they have a tendency to argue at the level of data. Well, you know, actually the facts are not this, the facts are that. Whereas what Obama did really well and what Biden often does well is argue at the level of personal narrative. Yeah. You know, I feel your pain, I understand why this happened to you, I'm so sorry, I'm here to help, etc. Much more meaningful at a personal level.
Yeah. And there's a famous example of this from back in the 1988 US presidential election, Michael Dukakis.
Mm.
The video clip's on YouTube. It's well worth hunting out as a really good example of how to get this wrong. So Michael Dukakis, Democrat candidate for president, opposed the death penalty, and he was asked in either as a TV debate or an interview, he was asked on TV how he would react if his wife was murdered. And he reacted with a very technocratic, rational answer.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, of course, if my wife was murdered, I would, yeah, the death penalty wouldn't be good enough for what I would want to do to the person appropriate for that. But you know what? The fact that I would be so angry in response to that and would be so violent in my initial instincts, which we all as humans are, that's the very reason why we need to have a legal system that takes a step back. Mm. And, you know, so there's a way of responding to those issues that can acknowledge the anger and the strength of emotion, as opposed to simply saying, oh, don't be stupid and emotional about this. Here are some facts.
Yeah. So I think, you know, your advice boils down to manufacture opportunities for Biden to demonstrate his person-to-person human empathy.
Mm.
But he has to do that from a basement.
Yeah, it's tricky. Alone. But if anyone can, Biden can.
Good luck with that, Joe. Yep. Your other book, we talked a lot about bad news today, but your other book was called 101 Ways to Win an Election. Would you like to throw, say, two or three ways to win an election at us?
Well, one of the things I talk about in that book actually is the Michael Dukakis example. Yep. I guess a couple of other things in there which are very relevant at the moment is I talk a lot about the importance of the message.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I love getting into details of the ground game and how you organise the on-the-ground campaigning and so on. But there's a limit to how much that can achieve. And the message is really important. And the message needs to work, as you were rightly saying earlier, Karen, for people who don't follow the details of politics very much. I love the example that a bit into the 2017 general election here in Britain, one in five people couldn't name who the leader of the Tory party was. Now, even though we were in the election. And that's not because they're stupid, it's because they decide to spend their time on other things. So in that book, I talk quite with my co-author, Ed Maxfield, we talk quite a lot about the importance of messages that actually work and the storytelling that has to sit behind them. One of the other things we talk about is actually how the first President Bush, one of the secrets of his political success was the number of thank you notes that he wrote. And one thing I've been trying to make, and I've not quite made a habit of myself, but is whenever I have a bad day or get frustrated, to find some gratuitous thank you message that I can send. And that might be to go and finally get round to posting a podcast review of a podcast I really like.
Yeah.
Or it might be saying thank you to somebody for something that, you know, I hadn't properly thanked them for before, or just finding some, you know, dropping a quick email to somebody to praise them. So if anyone is listening, it does ever get a thank you, you know, note or message out of the blue from me, it is genuinely motivated as well. But I find it's quite a good way of counterbalance. And, you know, the first President Bush really demonstrated how much your political career you can base on being really good at remembering to say thank you.
I always remember a story a good friend of mine told about having met Bill Clinton at a funeral one time. And he, you know, had a few seconds chat. It was a funeral of somebody who'd been active in a movement that my friend worked for disability rights. They had a probably 30, 45 second conversation. You know, it was substantive, but brief. And then he moved on. And he tells the story about, you know, a few weeks later, he received a handwritten note from Bill Clinton saying, "Dear Brewster, I so enjoyed meeting you at the funeral for so-and-so. And I'm so delighted to hear about your work on this and such an issue. Keep up the good work, Bill Clinton." And I just thought, now that's either he's got a fantastic memory or really good staff work. I'm just wondering, did he have someone behind him taking notes, or a bit of both? But I thought, what a great practice that is to just get in the habit of, because my friend now, you know, had been slightly ambivalent about Bill Clinton, but loved receiving that note. And he always remembers it. And he tells everyone, that's politics.
I wonder if Bill Clinton had sort of bugged himself, so he had a little audio recording so that staff could then afterwards work out what all the details were.
Maybe, who knows? I think
there are some people who are brilliant at remembering those little details in their conversation. Here in Britain, Shirley Williams was fantastic at a similar way of that immediate emotional engagement.
Mm. She was lovely. Right, Mark, have you got a few minutes to play the gut check game with me?
Oh, can I say no? This sounds worrying. The last podcast I did, it involved actually a quiz about chocolate. People who know me will know I quite like chocolate.
And
I
scored an
inglorious half out of five on that quiz. So I'm not in any way nervous.
Don't worry, you can't fail this test, I promise. All it means, the gut check game is I have in front of me on some bits of paper some things taken from the campaign trail. This week I have chosen a series of headlines from various different US-based news outlets. And I'm just going to read them out in a random order. And all we have to do is just react to it. And in particular, I'd love to hear from, you know, some of the tips from your book. What would be the things you would be watching out for if you read that headline? Yep. As you read the story, because you do a lot of things in the book that are really interesting about kind of look out for this, you know, this story, you know, check its validity. And you particularly, you talk about things like punctuation marks that can get you in a lot of trouble in headlines. So I'll pull a story out. Okay, here's one from Fox News, which we've talked about before. Quote, so the headline is "An Innocent Man." Subhead, Trump tears into Obama administration after DOJ drops its case against, quote marks, warrior Flynn.
Mm. So I think the thing this touches on is that immediately rings an alarm bell for me, or a note of caution, is that what happens with legal actions can often be relatively disconnected from the overall truth or not of something. So, for example, somebody might take out a legal action, but because it doesn't follow the right procedures, that legal action might fail, even though the allegations they might make are true. Or, for example, one popular form of news stories is based on what's said in court filings, where one side has filed its case. Mm-hmm. But the fact that something's been filed with the court, I mean, I could file anything. You know, I could make any claim in a court filing. That doesn't actually really take. So that reference to legal makes it sound more significant and more true than reading the rest of the story may well justify. Yeah.
Do you know the story that this is reporting on?
I don't think I do, actually.
Okay, so this is Michael Flynn, Trump's former national security advisor, who pled guilty to obstruction of justice and lying to the FBI. And the Department of Justice, even though Flynn admitted in his court hearing to having done this, the DOJ has now said that they don't have enough evidence and they don't think they can prosecute it. And it has been widely reported as being basically a intervention by William Barr, the Attorney General, into the justice system. So it's a very controversial, to say the least, case. And Democrats are absolutely furious about it, as are a lot of kind of legal scholars. It's very much contrary to, but you wouldn't get any of that context from this headline.
No, and also it sounds like this is one of those cases where who wins the legal argument may not be the same as what is true about the underlying events. And just to give another example, something that happened in Britain a few years back as a political funding scandal involving the Labour Party here, they got investigated and all of that. And in the end, nobody was prosecuted. So one way of covering that, and this was the predominant media way of covering it, was either that they were innocent or that it was appalling the regulators had failed to not. If you probe into the detail, the problem that the regulator said was that three different former Labour Party treasurers had given conflicting evidence and they couldn't work out which one was telling the truth. Right. So it's very legitimate to both think that, yes, the legal outcome was correct. How can you prosecute if you've just got three people's words against each other? And yet also think, despite the fact that no one was convicted, I'm sure somebody was guilty.
Yeah.
And so quite the truth in that sense and the legal outcome don't always go together.
Yeah. Here's another headline. Starts in quote marks, quote, full steam ahead, end quote, for Trump's convention, question mark. North Carolina has doubts.
That sounds like a desperately unsure committee can't quite work out what.
No, the committee is the entire state of North Carolina.
I mean, there's loads of indecision and doubt in that headline on its own. The couple of things to watch out for there is one is the question mark.
Yep.
Basic rule of news headlines is if the headline is a question, the answer is no. That is pretty nearly always the case. The other thing is the use of the phrase full steam ahead in quote marks. That sounds like that's a bit of rhetoric from somebody who may or may not be a well-placed source. Mm. And in fact, they may be somebody who has a commercial interest in the convention going ahead. So there are some people who will be wanting to talk up the likelihood of the convention going ahead because they are invested in the convention business and the knock-on economic benefits from a physical convention going ahead. So that, having a quote just like that, one of the things I would immediately think is, well, who is this person? You know, if that's Trump saying it, or if it's the chair of the national committee saying it, that's one thing. If it's anonymous quote or chief exec of the convention center business, that's a very different. So there's a whole, that quote may well not be nearly as strong a statement as it sounds on its own in the headline.
Yeah. So something to watch for as you read the story. I didn't say, by the way, that's a New York Times headline. I was really
that's the New York Times. That if you ever wanted to caricature the New York Times, you'd be hard pressed to beat that headline for pain.
Well, it is. That's what I thought. I was like, they have no idea what the story is here. I don't know what I'm supposed to
say. And the combination of quote marks and the question mark. And this partly gets back to actually one of the points I make in the book, which is I strongly suspect my conclusion at the end of reading that story would be nobody's got any idea. We're better off just concluding, don't know, let's come back to this story in the future.
Yeah. Here's another one. This is from MSNBC's The Chris Hayes Show. It says, coronavirus conspiracy theories are ravaging ERs and doctors are fed up.
Well, I guess this touches on one of the tricky points about to what extent should you talk about things that are untrue and do you risk giving them more airtime? The doctors are fed up bit rings a little bit of an alarm bell for me because, of course, that might be true.
Yeah,
I guess it probably
I'm sure true. There are doctors who are fed
but
up.
But it gives that sort of headline normally comes from a story that is based on some interviews. And it's really hard to tell how typical those interviews are.
Yeah.
And so you've got a real risk of it. What might sound like a convincing story because it's got extracts from interviews with maybe five different doctors, but they are in the end only five doctors. And how were those doctors chosen? How typical are they really of everyone else's views? And you know what? The doctor who has a slightly bland, boring answer is the one who almost certainly doesn't make the cut for the final story. It's a real giveaway that when in stories that quote lots of witnesses in that sense, none of them are the ones of the it's dull, it's boring, it's nothing to say, nothing really to see here. And that's not because that's never the truth. It's because that's just boring. Therefore, it doesn't make it into a news story. So I would be nervous about the implication of the source of the story and how robust that really is.
Yeah.
That would definitely be something to look for as I read through it.
I think it's a really interesting one because I watched the story that the headline describes, and it's a really interesting story. It's one that I think, you know, we would want to be able to report about. You know, there are protests happening. There's a lot of things that are disruptive in the hospital setting that doctors are having to deal with. And so they did interview some doctors with a very compelling case to make. And I was thinking to myself, how would I write that headline? Because I had the same reaction you did. It's like, well, I'm sure not every doctor in the world is fed up. And I'm not quite sure to what extent this is a valid description of the life of a medical practitioner. But equally, I would want to be able to hear from those doctors who are fed up because I thought it was an interesting angle on it. And I just wasn't quite sure how I would have written that headline.
Yeah, and what it also illustrates, thinking about the protesters' side of that headline, is the big majority of people are often cut out from the news story. So for every protester, there is probably certainly tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of Americans who take a different take on it.
Yeah.
But it's the one person with the gun and the balaclava that gets the news. It's all of those others actually sitting quietly and safely indoors for as long as they can each day who doesn't make it into the story.
And that is a really big problem in coverage of the coronavirus, because polling suggests, to the extent that you think the polling is accurate, but it seems to be consistent on this, that the vast majority of Americans support the idea of shutting down and staying home, and that most people are complying pretty well with this. It only takes a few hundred, which in, you know, a nation of 350 million or so, you can always find a few hundred people to do anything. And yet, of course, it's visually compelling to watch protesters out on the streets when the streets are otherwise empty. And it is a kind of a story that generates a lot of anxiety and interest. So it's difficult to find the balance between not covering it at all, but also putting into the context of they don't seem to represent a large, you know, certainly not even a majority.
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, there was a fascinating little problem, you know, within the last few days about trying to, the truth or not, about whether at one of these protests somebody was holding up a sign with a Nazi slogan on it. Mm. And the truth got very messy because there was a previous fact-checking story about a similar sign, but at a different protest, which people wrongly thought was about this particular protest. But it certainly does seem to be the case that some of the protesters are deeply unpleasant people. And in a way, the correct response, maybe not correct, but the response at least I would take is to say, okay, because of coronavirus, deeply unpleasant, nasty person is now doing this. If it weren't for coronavirus, they would be doing something else. It's not that, oh my goodness, you know, society is all going wrong or something like it's deeply unpleasant people choose the way in which they express their unpleasantness depending on the situation. Now, I'm sure amongst the protesters, you know, that's not the only group of people there.
But I'm sure there are good people.
That, you know, but it is an illustration of how you need that broader context.
Yeah. I think that's, and that kind of flags up something that's probably a running theme, which is that that's the harder way to cover the story, because to cover it that way, you can't just go to the protest, take some pictures and report on it. You have to find out who are these individuals, you know, what do they do when they're not doing this? You know, have they got previous form in protesting? You know, what are the issues that engage them? And that can be hard to identify. But as you say, in many cases, what happens when you scratch beneath the surface is that in this particular case, you're finding some of these people have some very unsavory right-wing connections.
And also, and you know, I guess there may well be some people in some of the protests who have a legitimate complaint about an element of how the lockdown has been implemented in their state.
Yeah.
Certainly I'm aware that in Britain, although we've had nothing like those sorts of protests, if you look at the different government support packages, there have been all sorts of little wrinkles and omissions and mistakes made along the way in drawing them up. So it would be amazing if across all of the different US states, there weren't some legitimate grounds for complaint that might be being wrapped up in some of these protests. And it's striking that in the news coverage, at least I've seen here in the UK of it, there's no sense of whether the media have really tried to find that out or not. Now, maybe they have and none of that exists, but you're at best, you're just taking it purely on trust that there is nothing that has gone wrong with any detail of any regulation that might therefore incite somebody to protest.
Right, one last headline to end on. This is a fun one. It's from Channel 2 News, CBS Pittsburgh. And it's, I'd take her in a heartbeat. Joe Biden says he would pick Michelle Obama to be his vice president. What stands out for you there?
I would be amazed if that is not a quote taken out of context. because if it were true, why is it not the BBC News headline as well this morning? But be that phrase, it's really easy to imagine contexts in which that answer that is quoted is essentially in a different world from the current one in some form. So that's definitely,
it's the conditional, isn't it, that I would.
It's exactly that. That's definitely a, what was the question that he was responding to needs to be known before you can judge the story.
Yeah, yeah, Absolutely. It's a bit of wishful thinking on the part of the media in this case, I think, because it would be such a great story to cover. But if you read, and the story is kind of just, I had a look at it kind of straightforwardly. And to be fair, I don't think he was necessarily quoted out of context. It's, you know, would you consider Michelle Obama for your VP? And he says, of course I would. I'd take her in a heartbeat. She's wonderful. I adore her. She's great. But it's only kind of at the bottom of the story that he says, of course she has no interest. It's not going to happen.
Exactly. It may well be that he gave that answer because he knows it's not going to happen.
Yeah, and he kind of says that
it was a real prospect. Yeah. And indeed, you know, the very fact that he says he would pick her illustrates that he's not going to pick her.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the headline doesn't make that clear, but you can kind of get to it by he says he would pick Michelle Obama. Well, if she were on his shortlist along with lots of other people, he would be more circumspect, wouldn't he? He would have to say, yeah. Well, you know, there are so many wonderful people we're looking at. Michelle's obviously on the list, but we're looking at everybody else. It's not going to happen. And I think that, you know, whilst being accurate
himself.
No, he would be in scooping himself indeed. Although Joe Biden has a tendency to do that. So.
That's true, actually.
Mark, listen, it's been great talking to you. Any final thoughts before we go?
No, it's been absolutely fascinating talking with you as well. I guess the sort of the note on which I end the book is maybe a good sort of final note here as well, which is that the news might be bad often, it might be poorly put together, misleading, etc. But if you know what to look for, whilst the news might be bad, we don't have to be. We can be smarter and better than that.
Well, there you go. That's the good news, isn't it?
Exactly.
Let's leave it on that note. Great to talk to you, Mark. Talk to you soon.
Likewise.
And that's it. As always, you can reach me on Twitter. I'm at KarinJR, that's K-A-R-I-N-J-R on Twitter. If you are an American voter listening to the sound of my voice, make sure to register to vote and request your absentee ballot as soon as possible in this election cycle. Remember, even if you've registered and voted before, that doesn't necessarily mean that you'll still be on the rolls this year. It's important to re-register and request an absentee ballot in every election cycle, this election, perhaps more than any other in our history. And in particular, I would strongly urge you to request your ballot be an absentee ballot this year. We don't know what's going to be happening with the coronavirus by November. Better to get it sorted out now. So votefromabroad.org if you're an American abroad like myself, or vote.org if you're an American at home. As always, I should let you know that this podcast is not affiliated with any other organization or entity. It is just me here, and I wish you a very happy week.